Good morning and welcome to the St. Paul's podcast for their Bible study. We are still in the Revelation to John, and we're going to be looking at chapters 17 and 18 today, if we possibly can. And so I beg your patience as people begin to arrive into our Bible study, and we will get started in just a moment.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Good morning.
Good. Good to see everybody.
Good morning.
Morning.
If everyone is willing to stay about 5 minutes after the Bible study, I received a request that we think about what Bible study we might wish to do after this one. And I'm not going to make that decision on my own, but I would like to discuss it with everybody. So if you're willing to stick around a couple minutes.
I have a meeting. I have to be at 11 o'clock, so I'm going to have to.
That's good. Just anyone who wants to stay and discuss it can. Okay. Let's let Donna log in successfully, and then we'll get started. Today we are looking at chapter 17, and I think we'll be able to go on and do 18 as well. So chapter 17, a little bit of an intro for you, for both 17 and 18. Chapter 17 might be one of the more difficult chapters for us, as we are all in this room, using the word metaphorically, of course, women. And chapter 17 really hits gendered images pretty hard. We're going to be talking about the Whore of Babylon. And in chapter 17, we're essentially looking at one side, the evil side of the archetypal woman. Now, there's the evil side and the good side, and it's worth thinking about what ancient Hebrew people thought was the perfect archetype of the good woman, because what we have depicted here is the perfect archetype of the bad woman. So if we don't know what's on the other side, it's hard to put into context why they're characterizing Babylon and the whore just in quite this way. So these images, both the good and the bad, are all tied up predominantly in images of sex and images of religion. Because religion was really, in as we see in the Old Testament, the greatest way that good and evil were considered, and everything was thought of in a religious context. But sex was number two. And even sometimes they will use sexual imagery and use it as a stand-in for other kinds of issues that they're really talking about. Like, if they're really talking about idolatry, they might call it fornication. You see what I mean there? So they're actually talking about religious idolatry, like worshiping other gods. But over and over again in the Old Testament, we see God talking about God's relationship with the people of Israel. And we see the people of Israel talking about it in the same way, as a relationship between a man and a wife. And so, pardon me, so adultery isn't cheating on your husband, it's cheating on God in these contexts. And so it all gets a little mushy sometimes, but a secondary issue here, and we see this a lot more in chapter 18, and so this kind of flows into the introduction to chapter 18. We see a lot of issues about consumption, consumerism, and the trappings of wealth. And chapter 18 hits this pretty hard. It is less maybe about gendered issues of archetype and more strongly about the terrifying effect that wealth can have on a people to corrupt and destroy. Now, chapter 18 might be difficult for us to hear in other ways, not as gendered people, but as people from a wealthy nation. And as people who have greatly benefited from the Roman Empire as one of the foundation stones of Western civilization. And there is a great irony, because it is in, I think it's in chapter 18, it might be in chapter 17, where we see one of the most direct references connecting this image of Babylon with Imperial Rome. And that is when it talks about Babylon being on seven mountains, or, you know, the whore of Babylon riding seven mountains. And Rome was built on an area with seven hills. You could poetically call them mountains, but let's be clear, they're hills. And so that would have been a reference to all the people who were listening to it at the time. Oh, he really is talking about Rome. We can't interpret this any other way. He's talking, when he talks about Babylon, he's talking about Rome, period, the end. You know, he just mentioned the seven hills of Rome. So what might have been, it's possible that chapter 18 might have been the most difficult for the people at the time to hear, because all those seven cities that we heard mentioned in chapters 1 and 2 of the Revelation to John, Philadelphia and Sardinia and Laodicea, all those cities, even though they were in Asia Minor, they were still part of the Roman Empire, and they benefited hugely all throughout their society and their culture and their commerce. Everybody benefited from being part of Rome. And in chapter 18, we see John the Revelator just flipping out about the evilness of Rome, the excesses of Rome, how Rome is a corrupting influence to all the world and everywhere it goes, and how no one should participate. The deepest irony, perhaps, is that not too many years later, a few, 100 or 200 years later, forgive me, I'm terrible with dates, the Roman Empire absorbed Christianity. So remember this. Not everybody liked Rome. Paul wanted Christian communities to pray for Roman rulers, so they would be moderated by the influence of God, and they would have their hearts changed, and they would be influenced by the positivity and, you know, and the vibe. John, we see again, kind of comparing and contrasting to the Apostle Paul. John wanted a complete separation, not a physical separation, not for them to live sort of in sequestered communities, because there were some people who wanted that, and they wanted it very clearly, and they were very clear in their instructions. But John wanted people to live totally apart from the wealth that Rome had and produced, because it was the wealth itself that was a corrupting influence. And John was not willing to compromise on this idea that wealth is corrupting. And so all of the images that you're going to come across in chapter 17 and 18, they vilify wealth. And it seems in chapter 17 like they vilify women as well. But there is the other side of the archetype. You know, in chapter 17, we're going to see an image of a woman who is incredibly arrogant, but that is actually meant to contrast against a woman who is incredibly humble. Because they exist and they're good and we love them. And you're going to see a woman who is depicted as totally unfearing of God. But this is to contrast against a woman who obeys God, who listens for the voice of God, who wants to be part of God's plan. And, you know, coming off of Christmas, as we are right now, we have all heard at some point during Advent or actually Christmas night or Christmas Day, we have heard Mary say, I am the servant, or I am the handmaid of God. Let it be to me according to thy will, depending on what translation you heard in church. And so right there, we have Mary, the mother of Jesus, participating in that beautiful archetype of the faithful Jewish woman who's doing what God's telling her to do, even though it's scary, even though she's risking everything. And two, in her song of praise, which we have later titled the Magnificat, she sings the same kind of song of praise that faithful Jewish women have sung before her. I speak specifically of Hannah in the beginning of 1 Samuel, and I speak specifically of Elizabeth, who, if you look in the account of Luke, Elizabeth, her cousin, who is the mother of John the Baptist, also sings a song of praise. And then also in Exodus, we get the song of Miriam, which is rather short, and then it's kind of expanded in the song of Moses. And so the question is, was that really the song of Moses, or did he just steal Miriam's song? Who knows? But we get these four songs, and you know, they're put in kind of poetic meter in most Bible editions. We get these four songs of women, from women, of praise of God. And one of the enduring themes of these songs isn't just about the strength of God and the love of God and the charity of God, but also this idea that God takes the poor and the humble and lifts them up. And God takes the arrogant and the proud and throws them down. This idea of the reversal, where the poor and the humble get lifted up and the arrogant and the proud get thrown down, is really common. And we see it in these songs of these four women. And arguably part of the Song of Moses, but you know, whatever. And so that's a little bit of the contrasting archetypes of faithful and unfaithful women in the Hebrew culture. And so even though John is part of the early Christian movement, again, he's very strongly impacted by this Hebrew culture that he grew up in and that he was marinated in, and that so many of his followers and his friends also grew up in and were also marinated in. So from John, who we have discovered is rather an angry and violent person, we're gonna see the ugly archetype, but that's not the only story going, and I wanted to be clear about that. Now, are there any questions on the introduction before we get into the text? Okay. Is there anyone, particularly anyone who hasn't had an opportunity to read lately, who would like to read chapter 17, and then someone else who would like to read chapter 18?
One.
I can do a little dance.
I can read one.
All right, Donna, you're up for chapter 17. Okay. Would someone like to read chapter 18? Sue? All right, Sue, you are up for chapter 18. Hit it, Donna.
Okay. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great whore who is seated on many waters. with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and with the wine of whose fornication the inhabitants of the earth have become drunk. So he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. And on her forehead was written a name, a mystery: Babylon the Great, mother of whores and of earth's abominations. And I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly amazed. But the angel said to me, "Why are you so amazed? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will be amazed when they see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come." This calls for a mind that has wisdom. The 7 heads are the 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. Also, they are 7 kings, of whom 5 have fallen. One is living, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an 8th, but belongs to the 7, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you talk are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour, together with the beast. These are united in yielding their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he said to me, "The waters that you saw where the whore is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the whore. They will make her desolate and naked. They will devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by agreeing to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God will be fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth."
Thank you, Donna. Go on, Sue.
After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his splendor. He called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. It has become a dwelling place of demons, a haunt of every foul spirit, a haunt of every foul bird, a haunt of every foul and hateful beast. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxury." Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, so that you do not take part in her sins, and so that you do not share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her as she herself has rendered, and repay her double for her deeds, and a double draught for her in the cup she mixed, as she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, so give her a like measure of torment and grief. Since in her heart she says, 'I rule as a queen, I am no widow, I will never see grief,' therefore her plagues will come in a single day, pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned with fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her, and the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see smoke of her burning. They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, "Alas, alas, the great city, Babylon, the mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, since no one buys their cargo anymore, cargo of gold, silver, jewels, and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet, all kinds of scented wood, all articles of ivory, all articles of costly wood, bronze, iron, and marble, cinnamon, spice, incense, myrrh, frankincense, wine, olive oil, choice flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses, chariots, slaves, and human lives. The fruit for which your soul longed has gone from you, and all your dainties and your splendor are lost to you, never to be found again. The merchants of these wares who gained wealth from her will stand far off in fear of her torment, weeping and mourning aloud, "Alas, alas, the great city, clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, with jewels, and with pearls, for in 1 hour all this wealth has been laid waste." And all the shipmasters and seafarers, sailors, and all those whose trade is on the sea stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of her burning, "What city was like the great city?" And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, "Alas, alas, the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her." Then a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone, threw it into the sea, saying, "With such violence, Babylon and the great city will be thrown down and will be found no more. The sound of harpists and minstrels and flutists and trumpeters will be heard in you no more, and an artisan of any trade will be found in you no more. And the sound of the millstone will be heard in you no more, and the light of a lamp will shine in you no more. And the voice of bridegroom and bride will be heard in you no more. Your merchants were the magnets of the earth, and all nations were deceived by your sorcery.
I'm in the meeting, hon.
And in you was found the blood of prophets and saints.
Okay, bye.
And of all who have been slaughtered on earth.
Thank you. Let's let that sink in for a moment or two in silence. Give the introverts a moment to arrange their thoughts, and then I will bring us out of the silence and ask for questions. What do you notice in chapters 17 and 18? What stands out for you?
To me, 18 seemed like a metaphor for what we're living through in the United States.
In what way?
In an hour, all will be lost, and it tells how other great kings and the merchants. So we have both of those things happening in the news. The other countries wondering what on earth has happened to us, and what on earth are they going to do if we're not there? Or if we are there, how true are we? And the shipping lanes, sky or water, rail or whatever, are all clogged up with mismatch of stuff. And it's
I have heard that New York City was returned through at the Horror Babylon.
Well, let's address the Horror Babylon issue first. Anything someone in Christendom doesn't like is called the Whore of Babylon. Yeah. It's just what we do. It's how we insult people. When we want to insult them real good, when we want to not just stick them with a knife, but twist it afterwards, we call them the Whore of Babylon. So let's think for a moment about what that means. First of all, it's not very kind to women. And I'm not even counting whether or not you think sex workers are real people. And whether or not you think human trafficking is really an issue or not. I'm just looking at it from the ways that most of the sexual ways we refer to women are intensely derogatory and insulting. And most of the sexual ways we refer to men are intensely complimentary. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. What's your question, Jeanette?
Yeah. Can you say we? We refer to women or we refer to men. Who's the we?
Good question. Very good question. I mean the common parlance of American English. In common parlance of American English, when you want to be truly insulting and you don't mind having, if you will, blue speech, and I'm about to swear up a blue streak, so prepare yourselves, ladies. All of the gendered ways we insult people, most of them veer toward the female gender. Very few of the ways we insult people that have gendered overtones veer toward the male gender. So there's bitch. There's whore. Even calling a man a douchebag, that's a gendered reference and it's a woman's gendered reference. Calling a man a pussy. Now, you could also call a guy a dick. That's a gendered reference and it's skewed toward the male. Okay. It's one of the few. It's one of the few.
Can you hear me?
You're breaking up.
I said bastard.
Bastard.
Yes. That's a male, right?
Right.
But Liz, are you, or Sarah, are you frozen?
I think so. She's still in the same position.
Yeah. Hello,
Sarah. Are you
back? Am I unfrozen?
Yeah.
I thought to myself, why is everyone else frozen? And then I thought, oh, it's probably me. Okay. Let me roll back what I was saying a little bit. But if you call someone a slut, it is a female reference and it is an intensely sexual reference. Mm-hmm. But we've actually had to, there's no male equivalent. We've had to create a male equivalent by calling someone a man slut, which is still a female reference, because, or a man whore, which is still a female reference, because the male version of commenting on how frequently they want to have sex and with how many people they want to have sex is a playboy. And that's not quite as derogatory.
No.
Or a stud, which in some circles is a compliment. And so there we see, especially when sex is concerned, we see a vast discrepancy. When a woman has a lot of sex and we observe that, we seem to not have a lot of complimentary language with which to comment on it. We seem to only have, kind of naturally, in the English language as used in the standard American vernacular, derogatory language with which to comment on how much that woman has sex. And for the man, we seem to not naturally have derogatory language with which to comment on how much he has sex. We seem to naturally only have complimentary language with which to describe how much he has sex. So that is in particular what I want to highlight, because what we're dealing with here is the word whore, which is another very derogatory way to describe how much a woman has sex. So, the whore of Babylon is something we call people, and some of us, you know, mean to reference this apocalyptic figure that John has described to us. But in the post-Christendom world, not everybody is all that biblically literate, but the references are still in our language. Just like we also have lots and lots of references from Shakespeare in our language. Doesn't mean everybody has the plays memorized or is even vaguely conversant with more than a few of them. So we reference things that we don't necessarily embrace the full meaning of. We just reference them. So I'm trying to remember what Sue's comment was. Sue, can you remind me?
I was just comparing Revelations to today.
Yes. Which
I know that every generation has something that they compare to the Revelations.
Yes. And, you know, it's possible that, especially in chapter 18, every generation who has had wealth, and at least thus far in recorded history, every generation who has had wealth has also had corruption. We haven't seemed to have a portion of recorded history yet that has managed to deal with wealth without it being a corrupting influence. Maybe one day we'll get there. That would be super great. That might resemble the kingdom of heaven, actually. But we're not there yet. And so this evocative picture of the fall of a great and influential society that has wonderful wealth and luxuries. And, you know, even in the ways that John the Revelator is describing how the wealth is trickling down, it's not just staying at the top. The merchants are getting wealthy. The traders are getting wealthy. Anybody who owns a ship is getting wealthy. You know, everybody's getting in on it. In our capitalist economy, that would be seen as a good thing.
The economy's doing well.
The economy's doing well. And so, from a certain perspective, what's the problem? Oh, wait. The problem is that John and the people that he hangs out with and the people that he is talking to, at least some of them, maybe not all of them, because there is likely to be at least one wealthy person or family in each church. And they're usually like the patron who's hosting the meetings and that sort of thing. Or at least that's how it is in the churches that we have more detailed recordings of at this time. So the difficulty is the systemic injustice. And, you know, here in the 21st century, in our modern world, in our modern Western world, We've been talking a little bit more about systemic injustice, systemic racism, systemic poverty. You know, I know that you guys at St. Paul's support School 6 as well as the suburban elementary school across the street, because that idea that if you can give children of every stripe the best education possible, then you can remove one of the foundation stones of systemic poverty. And that's the whole Say Yes to Education movement. It's beautiful because it's not just charity. It is not just, if you will, giving a person a fish to feed them for a day. It is teaching them to fish so that they can feed themselves for a lifetime. It's that kind of juxtaposition. We're very aware of that. And most of us care whether or not we can personally go volunteer, whether or not we have the money and the sufficient income to make donations. We care about it. We have compassion. We have mercy. I want to remind you that mercy was not a concept that had a word in Latin. The Roman Empire did not know mercy. They knew clemency, which you might say, oh, hey, that's a synonym. No, it's not. Clemency is wiping someone's record clean because they are useful to you. And so you don't want to kill them because they're useful. Mercy is recognizing all the things they've done wrong and actually forgiving them anyway.
Big difference.
There is a big difference, though a Roman might say, no, you're splitting hairs there, because forgiveness isn't real. So even people who maybe aren't being so active in our present modern world can still feel compassion for people who are downtrodden, poorer than they are, sicker than they are, in more pain than they are, in more emotional turmoil than they are. That is possibly, and I say possibly, more prevalent in the modern world than it was in the ancient world. It is likely one of the ways, through the influence of Jesus and Muhammad and Buddha, that the entire world has spiritually evolved. We've all been able to take one or two steps, large steps, closer to God. And so 2,000 years ago, it was different. And yet, they saw some of the same problems that we still have today. Jeanette, go for it.
In chapter 17, right around verse 8, what does the beast represent? The beast, you know, with the seven heads and 10 horns.
Mm-hmm. So they go into a more a deeper description of what the seven heads mean. Those are the seven hills of Rome. What the horns mean, those are kings, future and past. And so one of the ways a commentary has described it that I think could be useful to think about is, if you think about the whore of Babylon being, like the actual person riding the beast, being Imperial Rome, and you think of this giant, crazy looking beast as the reach of Rome. Because Rome wasn't just Italy, well, and Rome wasn't just a little town, kind of in the center on the left of Italy. Rome was this gigantic empire, and the way the empire functioned, in case anyone is a little bit fuzzy on the details, is it would go into a place only through just war. But the ways it considered just war, trying to follow their logic, would twist your mind into a pretzel. They fabricated reasons to invade people, but they always considered that it was just from their own perspective. So they would invade the next neighboring place from where they were, and they would subdue the populace, and they would make an agreement with the people in charge. And if the people in charge were not willing to make an agreement, they would take them as slaves and parade them back through Rome. And they would put other people, local people, in charge who were willing to collaborate with Rome. So they would have, if you will, client kings in place. And then they would install Roman governors who were Roman citizens in place to coordinate with the client kings. And then they would say, what is all the best of your culture? We will appropriate it. We will incorporate it into that which is Rome. And here is all the best of our culture. You may have it. Feel free to use it in your own country and in your own way. And they built roads, and sometimes they built aqueducts if they were necessary. And they, one of the final things, and this is something that was pretty new in the Western world and pretty unique to Rome until the United States of America was born. The thing that Rome would do, that nobody else would do, is they would give these new client nations, whom they had subdued, opportunities to become citizens. Not everybody, you understand. You had to be interesting. You had to be worthwhile. You had to be someone good and useful. But if you were a native of Palestine, you could become a citizen of the Roman Empire. Paul was a citizen of the Roman Empire and an official in the Jewish religion. He was a native Hebrew. He was not a convert to Judaism. And so this was strange and unique, and no one in recorded history had done this before. And no one in recorded history had done it since, until the United States of America had so willingly accepted new people into its own borders. Granted, Rome expanded its borders more than allowing new people in, and giving them avenues to become citizens that were not totally unreasonable. And Rome also gave avenues for slaves to become free and citizens. And so Rome was a little strange and wonderful in that way. But that is part of the point I wanted to make. And I am so sorry because I have completely lost the rest of it. Jeanette, do you remember what you asked me? I'm sorry.
Just ask you, and then you add into the Roman Empire.
I'm so sorry, I heard one word in four. Okay. Does anyone else have a comment or a question?
I have a comment. It strikes me as very interesting that an ancient piece of writing like the Book of Revelations can mirror so many world historical events that the people living through them at any given time, because we know that over and over people have pointed to this book as being prophecy and momentary prophecy even. And the world goes on. And we keep doing the same thing over because we're so repetitive. I mean, we fit right into the pages. And other people have said that too throughout history. It's humanity maybe evolves in some ways, but we certainly haven't improved a lot in our treatment of one another.
What do you guys think about that?
Well, I don't know that we haven't improved. I mean, we're maybe not there. You know, we at least have finally gotten rid of slavery, at least in this nation. not in all nations. So I think there's been improvement, but I don't think it's where we actually would want to be in the long haul. But you know, we in this country, like the doctrine of manifest destiny, where we just took over the West, and it was our right, our Christian duty to do that and to kill off the Indian culture. And, you know, we did awful, awful things to our Native Americans. And we're still trying to undo some of that, not very successfully. When you destroy a culture, it's very hard to put it back together again. Puzzle doesn't fit like it used to if they're not allowed to be a culture. So we're still, I agree. I think, you know, we're still doing things like that. But I think
they're kind of backsliding with the white supremacy being becoming so dominant in the U.S. now.
Your sound is breaking up. I don't know why, Jeanette.
I can't understand what you're saying.
I'm getting partial words.
I don't know why it's breaking up. I'm saying the U.S. is backsliding because of the white supremacy becoming such a big factor.
Well, that's...
Give me just one moment. I'm going to see if I can maybe fix... No. Jeanette, another time, you might want to look into your Zoom settings. There is an audio setting that sometimes messes with people's audio intake. And it's when they try to filter out external noise behind you. And it sounds like that's what's going on for you. So you may not be able to fix it right now, but look into that for the next meeting. And that might help.
Okay.
Because every now and then we do hear you clearly, but not regularly.
But
going back to Sue and Donna's point about the repetitive nature of this, I can't help but think myself about the repetitive nature of corruption. And, you know, I think about, and I think that Pastor Vicki has mentioned in her sermons, or possibly in conversations with you guys, that about every 500 years, the church has needed to kind of have a rummage sale, Phyllis Tickle calls it, clean things out. But the reason, and you see this most clearly with monasteries in like the first millennia, is like the monastery would start out and it would be very holy. And people would perceive it as a place of power, mm-hmm. a deep prayer, deep holiness, deep wisdom. And then a thing would happen. Wealthy people would give it money to try to get in on that holiness action, to try to get in a little bit of that spiritual power, you know, just in case. It's kind of a life insurance thing for the next life. And within about two generations, and it only ever took about two generations, that monastic community would become totally corrupt. And then it would stay corrupt for a little while, depending, one generation, two generations, three generations. And then they would clean house. And they would sweep away all the gold and get rid of it. And they would sweep away all the excess, and they would reform their habits, you know, what they wore. They would go back to a place of poverty, of relying only on God. And this is where it kind of comes back to Revelation as well, because having wealth could be seen as idolatry if you're depending on wealth rather than depending on God. So if you think your money will save you, well, that's idolatrous to the ancient Jewish mindset, because only God saves you. If you think all of your good comes from being wealthy, that's idolatrous, because good only comes from God. And if you're using your wealth to try to prove to others how holy you are, because, you know, wealth comes from God and it must mean that you're loved, then that's hypocrisy, because you're not really right with God, but you're trying to put on airs that you are with other people. Donna, you look like you had something to say.
You think it's just the nature of man to do that?
I think it's the nature of man who doesn't listen to God.
For some people, greed is just an inbred thing. The pursuit of money is the most important thing in making career decisions and making in living their lives. You know, there's a and this is where our generation or the future the younger generation, it's still there. Generations come and go, and then it's not as important in this generation, and then it's like, oh, whoa, the Wolf of Wall Street here, you know, let's go out there and make as much money as we possibly can, because that's really what it's all about. And I don't know, right from Adam and Eve, it seems like, you know, I mean, they managed to corrupt the Garden of Eden, right? And there are only just the two of them. So now multiply that by the billions that we now have of people, who, you know.
There's no hope for us.
I don't know. I think
these are excellent points. And, Grace's comment, there's no hope for us. Our hope is in Jesus. And I don't just mean that as the religious person in the room.
No, there's hope, but I think I believe there's always hope because I'm a Christian. But I don't, I think that, you know, so much of it is so circular. It just keeps going around and around. And, you know, Martin Luther saw the church as corrupt and, you know, nailed his edicts on the door of the cathedral, and things started to change. But then those become correct as well. You know, we still keep going around in circles on it, even within the framework of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or Muslimism, or any guiding spiritual religious kind of orientation. You know, there's the Muslims who kill, and there are the Muslims who are just decent folk like everybody else. And
well, and what it teaches me is that having a title doesn't make you good.
No, it doesn't.
You know, if my title is Christian, well, that's not automatic, is it?
No, it isn't.
Because there are Christians who are greedy, and there are Christians who are not greedy.
Right.
And having the automatic title priest
doesn't make
me good.
No, I know.
There are priests who are greedy, and there are priests who are not greedy. And, you know, and having all of the ways that we want to classify people, just because we're human and it helps us to sort out who goes where. You know, not in a way that we're trying to be overtly judgy. Just like, hi, who are you?
Right.
Could we be friends?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to stab me in the back? Do I want to hang out with you and go have salad and a coffee?
Mm-hmm.
Or do I want to avoid you every time I see you?
Right.
Just the standard way that we think about.
Do one good deed every day and hope it multiplies.
You know, there are great books about that.
Yeah.
That general idea, you know, what would humanity look like if we did one thing every day to make ourselves better people? Okay. There's a great book that I've been reading called Atomic Habits by James Clear. And he doesn't focus on doing good deeds for other people. He focuses on trying to be the best person that you can, because out of that comes grace and beauty and love and the kind of compassion that happens when people are just, they're full. They're full of love. They're full of hope. They're full of joy. And it just spills out of them. And I don't know about you, but I've known people who are incredibly compassionate, but they're not doing it out of a sense of abundance in their life. They're doing it out of a sense of poverty, and you can see how it pains them. It pains them to give. It pains them to help. And to be the recipient of that, as I sometimes have been, is also painful. because I feel like I'm taking where I should not take. And that's, you know, my own personal experience. And, you know, it's jaded by who I am. But I've also received help from people who are just overflowing. They help because they have abundance and they can help. And they're happy to do it. And it brings them joy. And that might, you know, there have been times in my life where that was surprising and stunning and wonderful. But it is what it is. And so what would the world look like if every single day, in tiny, incremental, even atomic-sized ways, we became better people and slowly went up versus, you know, how we're going to spend our lives anyway, either staying exactly the same or getting slightly more cantankerous. I just recently saw the Muppet version of A Christmas Carol, which, in case you haven't seen it, is surprisingly good.
It is good.
I did not have high hopes for this movie.
Oh, the Muppets are great.
I was there. I was there for it. I'm going to watch it again. You know, and so what the world looks like when we become subtly more cantankerous and start on that downward slope, and we're only adding a tiny bit more hardness of heart every day. It's almost imperceptible. Kind of like the way we can add a pound every year, and then suddenly, where did all this weight come from?
Right.
Whose arms are these? They're not mine. Right. You know, to pick a small random example.
Right. I have to leave the meeting. I have another meeting at.
Yeah, I do too. I have a meeting.
Okay.
I have to go too. Happy New Year, everybody.
Sorry.
See you next week.
Yep. All right.
Happy New Year, Donna and Grace.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
See you later.
Bye bye.
Okay.
Bye.
Ye who are remaining, do you have a desire to study some other book after this?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have any requests? Jeanette, can you type it in the chat? Okay, if you...
Oh, I see it.
There should be like a little chat box, maybe over in the more section.
We'll end up learning how to use this thing.
That's okay.
How do I send it?
You might be able to simply hit a button that says respond or reply. If you can see the message that I just sent that said, respond to this.
I can see that. I typed something in, but I don't know how
okay.
to send it.
Hit enter.
Okay.
I see your question. Jeanette asks, do you have suggestions? Well, my suggestion primarily is not something you've recently studied.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that when Pastor Vicky left, you guys were making your way through the Pauline letters. Mm-hmm. But that's all I really know. So...
We had covered quite a bit of the Old Testament.
You cover quite a bit of the Old Testament.
I would have to look back at my notes, but I think we did not do much with the Judges.
Okay, Judges. There's some fun stories in there.
Yeah, and I can't remember how much of Isaiah we did.
Okay.
It was
Isaiah is considered one book in our Bible. Okay, Ezra, there's another suggestion. Isaiah is considered one book, but it's really three different prophecies from three different people.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. There's really first, second, and third Isaiah. And you have to go deep into commentaries to see which bits are which. But first Isaiah is largely believed to be written by the prophet Isaiah. And then second and third Isaiah are written by, let us say, his students, prophets in the school of Isaiah. And so third Isaiah is just a couple of chapters at the very end. And second Isaiah is about half of the large book of Isaiah. And the real difference is that first Isaiah happens earlier in the diaspora, whereas second Isaiah happens as the diaspora is coming to a close. And so there's a bit of a different tone, and there's some different issues that they address. So possibility of Judges, possibility of Isaiah, possibility of Ezra. Have you done much with the prophets? No? Okay.
Not recently.
Not recently.
You know, not in the last, probably not in the last 5 years.
Okay. And do you have any interest in the other stories? I count most particularly Job, Ruth, Judith. What am I missing? Oh, what is her name?
Esther.
Oh, Esther. Thank you. Because those are edifying and very different. They're not prophecies of the end. Jeanette, you're gonna have to type it out. I'm sorry. Not Esther. Okay, got it. Okay, so what we've got so far is the possibility of Judges, Ezra, and Isaiah. Oh, cool. That's pretty neat. And so why don't we put this to the group and see how many people are interested in what thing, and that's how we'll go forward.
Sounds good.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for being willing to linger a bit and have this discussion.
Can that go out in an email to the others, to the whole group? So that
sure.
That aren't here and don't know what we talked about would be included in it?
Mm-hmm.
Good idea.
Okay. I will tell Liz about that. All right, thank you so much. Jeanette, I hope you get your sound issue fixed. I'm so sorry, I don't know what to tell you about that, but it may help to take all of any sound modification things and turn them off.
Yeah, Liz is helpful with that stuff too. I mean, she's helped me a couple times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And if you have a problem, yeah. Email Liz and see if she can help with that. Thank you very much. I hope that you have a wonderful new year, and I will see you next Wednesday.
How is your sister doing?
My sister, she's doing well. She is looking at the next surgery, which is not going to be brain surgery. It's going to be to put in what is essentially a pacemaker for epilepsy, which does not cure the seizures. Not like other potential surgeries that she's not eligible for might. But it seems to work pretty well in most cases. And by pretty well, over the course of a couple of years, decreasing seizures by maybe 70% or more. And they don't know why it works, but they know that it works.
Kind of like life.
So it's not nearly as invasive a surgery. It's not nearly as dangerous a surgery. And she's probably going to have it in the beginning of February. So that'll be great.
She should be on our prayer list.
Yeah. If you like, you could make that request. That would be lovely. Thank you.
Yeah, she will be prayed for.
Thank you very much, ladies. I hope you continue to have a very Merry Christmas, because we're still in the season, and a wonderful New Year.
Thank you.
I'll see you next Wednesday. Bye.